outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Chain.
Well, let's get right to it. Last week we began a conversation with Arnita Taylor, who's my friend, who's also the co-author with me and Bob Prater of A Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation. We're talking about a book called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism by Robin DiAngelo. So let's pick up where we left off last week. If somebody's coming to me saying what you said was hurtful, particularly if it's somebody outside my in-group, so like I have no idea what you're talking about, my next thing is going to be, okay, first of all, I'm sorry, but second of all, teach me. Teach me. Yeah. What did that do? Why did that hurt you? What did I say? I'm not sure I know what I said. I wish I did, but I don't. Yeah. So help me.
You know, I love that. I know the other day I posted something in our Language of Healing discussion group, and I'm like, why are we debating racism? I am not the girl. I will have a dialogue and a discussion with you, but I'm not going to debate racism.
Good for you.
So the minute you come at me, you want to debate racism. And I see that a lot in our dialogue in the group, which really shocks me. And I always go, have they really read our book? So that's, and I digress. But
how much of that is terminology, though, do you think? Can we discuss the white-black problem? That might get us a better discussion than, can we talk about racism? And that gets the defensive reaction.
Sure, sure. And that's part of the fragility. Yeah.
It is. But it is.
The fragility. It reinforces the fragility.
I think someone said in one of our live things, why her daughter said to him as a black man, why are we the ones that always have to apologize? That statement hurt my heart.
But it's a very true statement.
I know it is. I absolutely am not fighting the statement. I'm just going, that. Yeah. If you could see that, if people in my community could see that and go, oh, we really do need to talk about this differently. Yes, we do. We really do. And get over your white fragility. Get over it. Because it is a bullying tactic, which doesn't make it seem fragile at all.
It shuts it down.
It shuts down the conversation because I'm uncomfortable with it. Well, if you're uncomfortable with the discussion, imagine how uncomfortable they are with living, like you said, living that reality every day.
Yeah, living that reality every day. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like, and it just happens. It's always so reactive when people shut down a conversation. You just know, okay, well, we're done there. But I think when it comes to intentions and effect, what people intend, they kind of filter through what would be okay with them. Does that make sense?
Right.
My intention, yeah. I'm going to do something and say something that would probably be okay with me if somebody said it to me. It's just that other person receiving it is not you. So it's just wise to probably take a pause and go, how might that person hear it? Or like we talk about in the book, preface first. Say, hey, I'm going to say this. I do not mean any harm in this, but I'm going to go ahead and say this. And so I want you to know up front, I just want to talk about this. And that's just so authentic. That will just go so far.
It does. Opens doors.
That just goes so far. And it's just so simple. I think that's something that's really good. But, you know, I'm a little biased because I wrote a book about that. So
I did, too. Yeah,
I know. We wrote a book about this. So I'm a little biased. Yeah. I want to talk about why discomfort is such a part of this goal, of this walk that we're trying to walk. Why is discomfort critical to the growth of an individual and to our progress culturally as we relate to each other? And why is racial stress a bad thing? You know, we have a book called Being Disrupted, Willing to be Disrupted.
So a chapter, yeah.
It's kind of like that.
Yeah, I'm gonna sing your song a little bit. You talk about being growth-minded, which I think is incredibly a powerful thing. Growth-minded, if you're going to be growth-minded, you assume discomfort. That's how we grow. If you don't want to grow at anything, if you don't want to, you know, try something new, you've never played golf before, you've never fished, you know, and you want to go fishing, you're going to be out of your comfort zone for a long time to learn something new. And I think most people are so, maybe this is where white fragility comes from, are so fragile in society. Their egos are so fragile. Their sense of success is so fragile. They feel like such a failure. They're always trying to put out this image that I've got it all together. I've got it all together. And they work so hard to sustain this image. I think if there's anything valuable in this discussion for people, it's this right here. It's being willing to be close enough to God in your life that discomfort doesn't throw you. That for you to grow, you're going to have to be in some uncomfortable conversations. If you're going to grow racially, you're going to have to get to know people and be in environments that go, okay, I don't have all the answers here. I don't know what to say. I don't know that I might say the wrong thing. I think because we live in a world, and I think statistics bear this out, the more success our country's had, the more fragile people's egos have become, and depression and despair. And it's like, I've got to keep this image up. And that's maybe where California gets dinged worse than any other state in the nation. It's about that. It's all about image, pretending to be something you're not. And then a person who lives like that has no mental reserves for discomfort. None.
Yeah, that's interesting. Which, living life is uncomfortable.
It is.
Living life in general is uncomfortable with just normal stress. And I agree with you, being a coach and a pastor, people are very uncomfortable with things they're unfamiliar with. The unfamiliarity just throws people over the top. But we all face things that we're unfamiliar with. So we can't let that stop us. But it does stop us in this topic of race, because I don't think people think they have to have this talk.
That's the point.
That's stress that I don't have to add.
That's the point. White people can choose not to have this discussion and pretend the problem doesn't exist. And people of color cannot ignore this problem any day of their life or pretend it doesn't exist. And that's the conflict maybe between white black right now. White wants to pretend, hey, it's fine. Everybody, if you just do your best, things will work out great. So there's no problem. There's no problem. There's no problem. Instead of, no, there's a problem. We live it every day. How can we get you guys to join us in this conversation to make some effective changes? And that's going to mean discomfort. And yeah, we've got to choose discomfort. There's no growth without it. There's no growth internally, and there's no growth externally as a culture without it.
And I think people right now, particularly white people, they're counting the cost. There are some people in their families and some business retaliation. There's going to be things that they have to count the cost. How far do I want to go? Which is so sad. It's so sad that you have to make those type of choices. But certainly that shows you the extent of what racism is in our culture and in our country, because you shouldn't have to lose friends to have me as your black friend. Oh, that's crazy. That's just the most absurd thing in the world.
But it's true.
I just think that's terrible. But it's so very true.
It is true.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So true.
Unfortunately, it's true. And if I care about what you care about, then there are people in my community are going to write me off as a Democrat, liberal, progressive, just because I care about the discrimination black people experience in our culture, and Latinos too, because I've got a good friend who deals with it there. And now you're less a white guy if you care about that, which if nothing gets to people understanding privilege than that, that would be a great thing to say. Wow, I've got to treat you less because you care about a different group of people than I want you to care about. That's got to scream loud, I think.
Yeah, that's quintessential privilege. You're absolutely right. Now, you know, she talks about some statistics, and this is funny. It's not funny because I've lived it, and it's interesting that she brings it out so much. You know, I have said often that white people in America can live racially insulated. You really can. Yep. You can live racially insulated lives. Okay. I think I called it social segregation in our book. But what is it that you think about that most white people would prefer neighborhoods that are no more than 30% black? And more than half of white people say that they would not move into a neighborhood that was more than 30% black. How are we supposed to address that in 2020? That blows me out of the water. 2020.
Yeah, and what we're getting here is not people who go down and count the houses and say, okay, it's 28%. I can move in here. If it gets above 30, I can't. It's not that. It's just the perception that this is a less safe neighborhood if more black people live here. I think that's where it goes. And it's a deeply embedded in our psyche is that idea that the dangerous neighborhoods are more ethnically black or brown or whatever in California. I think that's there. So I think there's a certain, I'm feeling uncomfortable here just because, and that threshold is about 30%. That's when people decide to move.
Do you think it could all be another act of superiority. I don't want to be, I'm superior, so I don't want that many Black people to be in my neighborhood.
Oh, I'm sure that I wouldn't even doubt that that's true. I would maybe say, I think more true in the South, you have people who definitely do not want to live near Black people, period. I find that less out here. I find it wouldn't be so much that. It would be the concern about crime. But I do think there is an underlying, she talks about it, and statistics bear it out, the underlying sense of superiority that makes you feel like the neighborhood's going downhill if it becomes more ethnically diverse. Not even dangerous, just going downhill. And I want to be with better people, which is horrible.
Which totally reinforces the racism problem in America. It just does, because when you go to work, you treat that person with that same mentality that you don't want them in your neighborhood. It follows you into the workplace, and it follows you into the church house, and it follows you into the community, and it follows you into the shopping areas. It just follows you everywhere. And I am hopeful that people will be that honest. Now, I know that's got to come in steps, but I think people are going toward more honesty there, and that's the only way we're gonna have differences. Well, I want have a breakthrough there. I want to talk about.
Before we do that, can we talk about that last statistic? Because I think that's the most difficult one. That last one was 55% of whites surveyed say that, generally speaking, they believe there is discrimination against white people in America today.
I do believe there's discrimination against all people. Discrimination can go both ways. Then let me tell you why. Discrimination is I treat you differently on the basis of what I think about you.
Right.
That's what discrimination is. All people have prejudice and discriminate. All people. That goes in all directions. But racism doesn't go in all directions. It's more attached to a power and who can really stop my life. I do think if you go to some parts of South Dallas, Wayne, you're going to be treated differently because you're a white dude. Like I'm treated differently sometimes because I'm right up the road in Southlake. You know, it's just no different. But that's discrimination. It just means I'm being treated differently on the basis of how that person believes about me. It doesn't mean it's any bigger than that.
Like I read the statistic more that's talking about our systemic society. That it's harder to be a white person than a Black person today. There's people actually feel like, that 55% right there, because I hear it. When I start talking about some of this stuff and just say, hey, well, we experience racism too. It's harder to be a white person in America today because the Blacks have all the advantages. And I'm like going, you've got to really have a couple of screws loose somewhere in your head. Now, I remember a guy in college telling me, a white guy who's going to be a preacher and all that, he said, you know what? I wish I was a Black man. And I said, why is that? He said, I'd have more opportunities with the gifts I have if I was in a Black skin. I could really, which really underlied his racism of, you know, Blacks aren't very articulate. And so, I mean, I've got these gifts. And if I had Black skin, then I would have all this affirmative action stuff, put me in all the places. I just went, dude, you have no idea what you're talking about. And I think that's the people who react when they're right fragility. Again, I hate the word, but I understand what she's saying by it. Often say that to me. You know, Blacks have all the advantages now. All the laws are for Blacks. And I'm going, you've got to be out of your mind. That's what I think's crazy. Because if you think you are, or as your Christians say, Christians are the most persecuted people in America today. And I'll just say, man, you have no idea what you're talking about. Because as she says, you can't, the one quote she said, only white people are in a position to oppress people of color collectively and throughout the whole of society.
Collectively.
And that's why I just, for whites to feel that, even if we're going to make more room at the table, it looks like your power diminishes a bit. No, it doesn't. We're just making more room at the table. And maybe your power does diminish in the sense of you being the supremacy or the only priority. But man, it's not about losing power. It's about sharing power. It's about inviting others to the same places you enjoy.
Yeah. And you can do that when you see people as peer and equal. Until you see people as pure and equal, you will never do. You will rarely do that. Yeah. I don't want to be an absolute there, but you will rarely, rarely do that. Discrimination is real. Prejudice is real. I'm not going to ever, deny that. But racism, you can live a whole life and never be oppressed by a person of color. in America.
Yeah.
White people can. And that's kind of what she's talking about. And that's what people resent. So anyone who says that white people have more persecution in America than black people, that's a knee-jerk reaction. You're in your head, in your emotions, but you really haven't thought about it. But those are not people I'm going to have a conversation with.
I hear you.
Yeah. Those are tough. So can we move on to the blind side? You know what? I love what she brought out about the blind side. This is hilarious. So my family.
This killed me.
My family loves the blind side. Now, I can't wait for us to talk about this. Okay.
Me either.
So there was the blind side had so many inherent racist messages that one author, I don't remember the author was another person that kind of brought this out. Another woman was inputted into Dr. D'Angelo's book.
Right.
So tell me about, what do you think about the racist messages in The Blind Side? I saw them when I watched them, but I am an African American from Tennessee. So I looked at that movie with probably a whole different filter than you did. So let's talk.
But you said you enjoyed it? Your family enjoyed the movie?
My family enjoyed the movie. I didn't enjoy the movie so much.
Okay.
But you know, they're dudes and it was football. Okay, come on. They're looking at it differently than I'm looking at it.
Yeah, and I honestly, we'll list them here in a minute. I will, because I think it's important to hear what she said. The inherent racist messages of The Blind Side. I honestly, when I saw it, I've only seen it once. It's not one of my favorite movies that I watch again and again, but I thought, this is a pretty compelling story. Here's a black kid that's down and out, and this family takes him in, and they help him, becomes a pro football player. It's a great story as an individual story, but when it's in a movie and now it's a story that has metaphorical messages for the culture, and I don't watch a movie. I didn't watch this movie that way. I didn't.
Yeah.
So she lists this for those of you that are saying, I haven't read the book yet. Here's what she says, that the inherent racist message in The Blind Side, white people are the saviors of black people. Some black children may be innocent, but black adults are morally and criminally corrupt. Whites who are willing to save or otherwise help black people at seemingly great personal costs are noble, courageous, and morally superior to other whites. Individual black people can overcome their circumstances, but usually only with the help of white people. Black neighborhoods are inherently dangerous and criminal. Virtually all blacks are poor, incompetent, and unqualified for their jobs. They belong to gangs, are addicted to drugs, or are bad parents. The most dependable route for black males to escape the inner city is through sports. White people are willing to deal with the individual deserving black people, but whites do not become a part of the black community in any meaningful way beyond charity work. Oh my gosh.
She laid it out.
She laid the wood.
She laid it out. So why was that so hard for you?
It wasn't hard. I mean,
why was that so illuminating for you to see her write like that in the book?
Just how blind you can be to something that you see, you enjoy. It's a big movie in the white community. It's a big movie because it shows how unracist we are in the sense of how generous and kind. I mean, that's how most white Christians, I think, would view The Blind Side. Just, oh, it's a great movie. Sandra Bullock, same guy who produced The Shack. So, and also Just Mercy, which is a great movie, I think. So here you've got, you know, all these messages that completely go over my head when I watch it.
Yeah.
So when she starts on The Blind Side, I'm going, oh boy, what is she going to do with this? And then it's like one thing after another going, yep, totally missed that. But also taught that black neighborhoods are inherently more dangerous, that sports is the way for a black kid to escape the community. I mean, some of that I have been taught. I've been in conversations about that at younger ages, about those kinds of things. So it's like going, oh my gosh, I guess you didn't see it because you think it's part of reality.
Okay, I get that. So you just think that's just the way it is because you were taught that stereotype. And so that's just the way it is with all black people. They only get out of their inner city off of athletics.
You would never say that. You would never say never.
Sure.
But you would go, yeah, it's generally true. Yeah, the white person needs to save this poor black kid and gives him a chance at a better life. And yeah, and think it's noble.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a lot of tension for me in the movie, probably a lot more than anybody else.
That's what I want to hear about. Yeah. Talk to me.
There was tension for me, because as much as I loved the story, you know, I think that the as a mom, when he said he never had a bed, you know, that's the kind of stuff that got me.
Yep.
But the minute she went to the country club to tell her little friends what was going down and her country club friends kind of snubbed her, I'm like, now that's more real.
Yeah.
That's more real. I do not think for 1 minute one little 9-year-old white boy taught him how to play football. You know, it's just some stuff I thought this must be just for the movies, because this little boy didn't teach Michael Orr how to really play football.
Right.
We play football all the time.
Right.
So it's like that's probably just a stretch. I thought it was ironic that the lawyer, even the African-American female lawyer, was mean to Michael. I just thought, wow, you know, come on, really? You know, there was just nothing like more than likely Miss Tui wouldn't have been able to go up in the middle of the gang and come out alive. You know, she just, that was just the grace of God on that day. That's just not.
Yeah.
Some of it was just a stretch, and I didn't see any redeeming qualities about Black people. I really didn't. But again, I could see the other side of it. So I just kind of sat in the tension of going, wow, you know, I'm really glad that worked out for him. I did listen to one of his interviews later where he said he kind of talked about some of it being a stretch.
Well, yeah. But, movies always do that.
Yeah. So, but movies do that. So if I was looking at it from that perspective. So, yeah, I thought the reality, you know, that's Tennessee.
Because to increase the contrast, which is always what you want to do, how noble this family is,
yeah,
you got to make this side over here very dark. And you don't realize, I mean, I didn't watching it the first time, completely went by. You don't, the messages you're underlining, which are hurtful to a whole group of people.
Yeah.
And so one group celebrating this great movie of love, and the other side's going, the love in that, it's all pat me on the back, I've done a great thing. It's just, yeah, that's what made me hurt reading it.
Yeah. So it was interesting for her to bring that out in this book. I thought, well, that's pretty real. But it just reinforces the fact that we look at most things, all things, through our filter of how we're being socialized and what people are saying about me or how I'm feeling like I'm being marginalized. And we look at things from our own filters, and that won't go away.
Nope.
It can always be managed, but sometimes it's not wrong. It's not a matter of right or wrong. It's just, this is the way I see that. And you can see it that way.
But knowing you helps change my filter. Reading this book helps change my filter. And I think that's the value of exploring it. Yeah. I think knowing you it's helped me see things that I would not have seen, particularly for the continent. It wasn't just knowing you. People tell me, you know, I have Black friends or I have Hispanic friends, and I'll just say, have you ever talked to them about race? And they go, oh, God, no, no, no.
What do they say?
Yes. And they say, no, 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 I don't. We're friends. We dinner, we banter, we talk sports, we talk safe stuff. I think what was different, and we all talked about at Tracy's home that day when you and Bob and I were standing in the kitchen saying, I've never had a conversation this honest about your perceptions of our world, that you let us ask you questions, you joked about things, you let us in on things. We let you in on things that our side saying and thinking. That was an incredibly illuminating moment in my life. And I'm thinking, why haven't I had more of those? And I get white fragility is probably the reason. You don't go there.
I was going to say, herein lies the reason.
You just don't go there because you might say the wrong thing. Somebody's going to get offended. You don't want to offend anybody, especially. And yet, because we're so worried about that, we don't have the conversations that matter. Because it matters when I'm walking with Michael and he tells me about his neighborhood and I'm seeing the neighborhood through his eyes and his experience. And I'm a different person because I walked, I don't know, 3 different days, 4 miles with Michael. So I've walked.
Don't rub it in.
I've walked 12 miles with Michael. And man, I just, that stuff changes. That's why I think we said in the book, getting with people who aren't like you is so critical to your growth.
Really?
And if it's uncomfortable, embrace the uncomfort. Embrace it. That's where growth happens, in places where I'm not comfortable. And if this blindside thing offends you, embrace it. Embrace, why would I not want to understand how somebody else saw the movie? Because I know I can hear people, don't ruin that movie for me. I love that movie. Step back, take a look. It doesn't ruin the movie. It helps you see the movie in a better way. Yeah. And maybe that will change something about your filter. And None of us are going to become perfect at this in a lifetime, I don't think, but we can become better.
We can absolutely improve. I couldn't agree more. It's just even watching anything and understanding there is another perspective here. And they're not stupid if they don't see it my way. Just understand there's another perspective. A lot of the things in that movie, they weren't immoral things. I mean, we weren't dealing with sin necessarily. It's just we see those two things very differently. I see that movie and think, wow, they're going to think, I have two black male children. They're going to think that they're not smart and that they can barely read. They can be good athletes. You know, I know that that's how a certain extent of society always sees me this way. It's funny. I was at a friend's house one day and she introduced me to one of her white friends that I didn't know. And we were just talking about, you know, how people ask you about kids and stuff. And I said, I've got a couple of kids. And both of my children were in college at the time. I think Evan was in graduate school at Duke. And the lady looked at me and she said, so what sport does he play? And I thought, wow, how presumptive. Hmm. But you as an affluent white woman assumes that my non-athletic child, my musical child, was at Duke playing sports, where he's actually getting a double master's. And it was just so, I didn't know her, haven't seen her again. But it was funny how she was so free to ask me that question. And she was so wrong. But it's just, it reinforced that part of the blind side. I thought of that when I read that in the book. So
yeah, and that's so much a part of what, I mean, the movie is someone's story, hyped for film, like you said, stretched.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've got to see. It's the way it is an individual story. He didn't have a lot of education. He didn't have a lot of whatever. And sports became a way for him to get out. So people can say, what's a true story? What are you going to do? No, it's the way it was stretched that undergirds these racial stereotypes that then help us in the white community not see as clearly as we need to see. Yeah. Now that's the problem. I hope people can see that and still love the movie. Hey, you can love the movie. Just see through it.
Yeah, just see another aspect of it. Or, you know, watch it and sit down with different friends and talk about it. It's a
great
conversation piece. You know, I mean, after we brought it up on this podcast, everybody's going to go watch The Blind Side and go, well, I didn't see it that way at all. Let me call my friends. So hopefully that'll happen.
Yeah, hopefully it will.
Okay, so let's talk about Dr. D'Angelo's action steps. Minimize our defensiveness. Let's just stop right there a little bit. How do we help our listeners minimize the defensiveness without drinking alcohol? I'm just kidding.
I wouldn't be doing that anyway. I'd learn to recognize it. Learn to, when you're in a conversation, that thing rises up in you, you feel discomforted, you feel uncomfortable, and you want to lay the sod back over the hole so you don't have to think about it. Just recognize it and don't go there. I recognize it when I start getting defensive in a thing and I kind of take a deep breath and go, okay, I want to learn something here instead of give in to my defensiveness. So that's how I deal with it.
Do you think that's a maturity issue?
I hope not, but it probably is.
Yeah, it takes so much emotional intelligence to do that. So it's really got to be something that you want to place as a high value so that you can stop yourself and go, you know what, why is my blood pressure going up right now? And why am I skipping breaths? Because I'm so emotionally charged right now over a statement. And I do think it takes that level of consciousness to minimize defensiveness.
Even if you realize it 2 days later. That's what I tell people. You know, even if you didn't realize at the time you were getting defensive, but 2 days later, you're thinking about going, you know, I think I missed something back there. I think I got so defensive, I pushed them away. Go with that. Go call them up. Say, let's get together. I think I responded in a bad way. Didn't let me listen to you well. Do that, even if it's 2 days later that you realize you've been defensive.
Yeah. And another point she says is demonstrate our vulnerability. Well, I don't think you can have these talks without vulnerability.
You can't. And just what you said earlier that's in the book about, in our book, about, hey, this may be awkward, but let me say this, and I want to hear your honest response. Just making room for the fact that I may do something stupid, and I don't meaning to, and if it hurts you, you know, but can we talk? That to me is vulnerability, that you're just saying, hey, I'm willing to go down this road, not to hurt you. I just want to learn something, and if it does, then my bad. And if you're vulnerable, people will treat you well. People don't treat well the brash, I'm right, you're wrong. That's the kind that doesn't get treated well.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. Demonstrate our curiosity and humility. This is a very important one. I think curiosity, and I think in our book, Bob may have talked about curiosity. I think curiosity says to me that you have a desire to be more in my space. I hope that sounds right.
It's
says
good.
That you have a desire. You're not forced. It's just kind of like, I just kind of wonder. And so I'm going to come toward what I wonder rather than go away from it. And I think that's so very important. I don't want you to come at me to fight me and to debate me. I really don't. I want you to come at me because you have some whys that you want to be answered. And you can even go get another why, because I'm not the sum total of all intelligence or speak for all Black people. But at least hear my why.
Yeah. Or just even get to know me. Just get to know me. And I was at why, we've said this before. You don't represent all Black people. You are Anita. Your family life, your experience is a thing. It gives you insight into stuff I don't have, which is awesome. But so I don't think that curiosity thing is, I just want to get to know you. You'll learn a lot just getting to know someone. You don't have to ask them questions. You can just get to know them.
That's true.
And humility, I'm going to say this. When I read this, my first thought is, I don't think a white evangelical conservative Christian in America has any understanding of the word arrogance or humility. I think it swims in arrogance. And doesn't see it. I hear people all the time. They'll tell me some brash preacher just as the most arrogant human being I've ever seen on a planet, or some of their political leaders, just the most arrogant. And they'll say, "Isn't he so humble?" And I'll go, "You don't have a clue what humility is." And I think part of the stuff in this book, because you're part of the culture that's always right, always has preference, always has whatever, you can't see the arrogance you live in. And I think people like us have got to say, God, would you show me my arrogance? Would you show it to me? I want to learn to live. I want to open to people. I don't want to always be right. I don't always want to be first. I don't always have to, whatever. I think that's important. And I think I know I got a lot of white evangelical Christians that shut off the podcast a few minutes ago, but it's okay with me because the arrogance in my life, one of the biggest things God's unraveled in the last 25 years of my life, and I think he has plenty more to do, is not even just the arrogance of being white, just whatever arrogance of theological arrogance of I'm right about the way I see God and you're wrong, obviously, if you disagree with me. I think that's so embedded in our experience that we can't see it.
Yeah, that humility. Yeah, that is something. That's a force to be reckoned with. That is really a hard thing because, I think that you're right. This is what I find now that's so unbelievable is there's so many people trying to school me on being Black in America. That is hilarious to me.
Sad. Like, it's tragic. Oh my gosh.
What arrogance that is that you're going to tell me what it's like to be Black in America because something that's been happening in the last 4 weeks.
Yeah,
that in and of itself proves to me how out of touch you are and how little humility you have toward approaching me.
That just got to exhaust you.
Oh, well, yeah, it does.
Oh, my gosh.
I just say, okay. I just don't say anything else.
I love that. I love that you don't debate. I love that you don't. There are conversations worth walking away from. You can't convince.
Absolutely. Yeah. So she says we allow for growth. Stretch our worldview.
And the only way to stretch your worldview is to put someone else's alongside yours, right?
That's so true. You gotta add one.
And you don't get it from a book. You don't. You read about a worldview from a book. You get principles and thought. You want to meet another human being and see their experience.
That's so true. Ensure action, which goes without saying. In our book, we put three steps at the end of each chapter for people to go toward action. because most people will not do that.
I like you said that. We put it there. You put it there. This is our Anita put it there. A lot of those are yours. That's awesome. But yeah, do something. When you have a discovery, choose an action. Choose some action to reinforce it.
Some action. You know, it's interesting. A lady that I didn't know well invited me to lunch this week for us to start kind of this type of dialogue. And I loved it. I didn't know her well. And so it was kind of neat. Another action step she gives is to demonstrate that we practice what we profess to value. Now, that right there will preach. I just want to say Selah.
Me too.
I don't know what else to say.
Me too. Selah.
Selah. That's just good. And build authentic relationships and trust. That's such a good action step.
We've talked about that, yeah.
And we have interrupt privilege, protect, and comfort, which is at the very heart of white fragility. And interrupt internalized superiority. Again, right at the heart of it.
And I tell you, those last two, interrupt privilege, protecting comfort, interrupt internalized superiority, it's better. I think those are better in-group conversations than out-group.
You do.
I think I'm in a better place to do that with white people who might listen to me. That's why, I mean, I thought it was hilarious. You said about white fragility. Here's another white woman making millions of dollars off the black experience. And it made me laugh. I just went, oh, how
but
tragic.
But is that not so honest?
It is honest. And it's true. And I think for some of these things, I think black people should, if you can interrupt privilege when you see it, please do. It will challenge. But I want to say to white people, hey, when you see a white person acting in a way, you're going to risk the friendship. I did that. I was playing golf with somebody. It made some racist kind of joke, and it was kind of not really a bad one in the way we rate bad stuff. And I turned around and said, you know what? That kind of conversation is not helpful, particularly in this climate. And the whole foursome got very awkward for a hole or two, but it's just okay. He still wants to play golf with me, so I didn't ruin the friendship. I didn't think I would. But we're in a better place. Don't think because, I don't want to risk my friendships. Risk them, doggone it. Help people see what they need to see, even if it's going to take them 2 years to understand it.
And you'll actually see the strength of those relationships. Because at the end of the day, you're right. We've got to be able to challenge each other and challenge each other's fragilities and weak spots and just call stuff out that needs to be called out. And that's what you did.
So. And do it kindly and great. You don't have to be mean when you do it. Just do it graciously. Yeah. And I want you to know, after you said that to me, I downloaded another book called So You Want to Talk About Race.
Oh my gosh. By Yoma Ulu. I'm not going to read another book.
Oh, it's written by a black woman. And I just, it's all the same stuff, but I read it because I wanted her to make her million too. That's why I bought her book.
Well, can you go buy up a bunch of a language appealing so I can make some?
She can make your million. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to take a lot more books for us, and you only get a third of it.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's going to take me a minute.
Writing already doesn't pay well and unless you get a big bestseller of some kind. And then when you're only getting a third of it, that's even worse. Yeah.
Well, I think this is a bestseller. I think our conversation with white men and a black woman, it's not out there. It's not out there.
It's amazing what we're hearing now. I mean, we've gotten a call from the Minnesota Department of Corrections, maybe wanting us to do some stuff with them, a college in Texas. I'm getting some really input that says this book may be finding traction in a neat place. So
yeah,
I'm hoping it does. I think, like you said, it's unique in that we're having a conversation, not just about race, about sexuality and religion and all kinds of things. And how can we find a better way to talk about these things and not kill each other? So. Thank you for joining me again today, Anita. Always a delight. I feel like
Thank
we do this a
inviting.
Lot. And I know you're doing this a lot. I see your Facebook feed. You're on podcasts and video Zooms and discussion groups. And you go, girl. You get the word out there. I think God has given you a unique opportunity. I think the book has done that. It's given a place for your voice that I think God is honoring. And it kind of is a culmination for a lot of choices you've made in your life. And now God's saying, here's an open door, girl.
And you know what I love?
You to go through it.
After you read White Fragility, you were like, I process it different because I've heard a lot of that from you.
Yeah.
And I love that because my friends and people who know me are like, well, of course you should have written a book on it. You've talked about it forever. So thank you for inviting me into that space.
Oh, it's all that God's done in your life. The ways you followed him has opened a door. And to think out such, it happened on such a whim. that so you walked into a room I was in. Yeah, that was amazing.
So random.
Love you, sis.
You too. You too. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.